Welcome to Human Rights and the Digital, a podcast where we present voices and perspectives of human rights defenders in Uganda. We focus on how technology is being used to the realization of human rights. To learn more, visit www.digitalhumanrightslab.org. This podcast is supported by the Digital Human Rights Lab. Be sure to subscribe.
Welcome to another episode of Human Rights and the Digital Podcast. I am Philip Ayazika, your host.
And I am Charity Mugasha. So, Philip, how are you feeling today?
Great. Chilly morning. Is it a morning?
Right.
But I'm feeling great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm excited. It's a new year. There's a lot that's been happening since the last time we recorded in the past couple of months. We were faced with internet shutdowns and all kinds of crazy things happening in the digital realm. So, Philip, what do you think? What can you say is our topic today?
Our topic is an interesting topic, and we have an amazing guest in house. But in 2019, Uganda passed the Data Protection and Privacy Act, which is an act to protect the privacy of the individual and of the personal data by regulating the collection, processing of personal data or personal information, but also to provide for the rights of persons whose data is collected and the obligations of the data collectors, data processors, and data controllers to regulate the use or disclosure of personal information and for related matters. In this podcast, we would like to talk about data protection in Uganda, Charity. And really, our conversations are going to be about how effective has this law been over the years. I think it's now 3 years since its passing in 2019. So the questions are the citizens aware about the law and how can it be popularized? How did politicians in the just concluded elections end up with our phone details, really? We've been getting messages and calls and all these things. So those are the questions. And how do we protect ourselves from the big tech companies? The questions are really many, and that is why we're all here.
Yeah, a lot of exciting stuff. And we have a very exciting guest with us today to discuss all the aforementioned. We're joined by Silva Kayondo. Silva is a Ugandan and South African duo-trained and agile millennial lawyer. He's a social entrepreneur with diverse experience in emerging technologies, media, telecommunications, venture capital, and private equity. He's one of Uganda's respected thought leaders on the industry futurism, the fourth industrial revolution, and Africa's digital economy strategies. For his contribution, he has featured in Forbes, CNN, New York Magazine, The East African, and Ugandan Media. We're very delighted to have you here with us, Silva.
Thank you, Charity. It's a pleasure to be here as well for the first time.
How are you feeling today morning?
I'm good. Pretty positive and feeling happy. It's a Friday, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm end good. Of the week.
Yeah, yeah. To GIF.
Right, also yeah. Chinese New Year, so I feel a lot of positive vibes in the air today.
Awesome.
In 2019, a Data Protection and Privacy Act was passed. For starters, Silva, what should any and every Ugandan know about this act? I mean, what's an act?
Yeah, so an act is a legal instrument enacted by Parliament of Uganda or any other parliament in the world, because acts what we use as law in Commonwealth countries. So when we elect political leaders such as MPs, among other obligations we entrust them with is to make laws for the governance of the country. So some of these laws are internationally motivated, others are locally situated. So in the context of laws such as the Anti-Money Laundering Act or the Data Protection and Privacy Act, those could be largely out of international development of trends that have impacts also on our local economy and rights and obligations. Yeah, so really an act is that. Then to operationalize that act, you make regulations, which is sort of a delegated mandate, usually to the minister, to make administrative procedures on how the act will be implemented. So as it stands now, we await the regulations to fully operationalize the Data Protection and Privacy Act.
In just a few words, what do you think each and every Ugandan should know about this act?
Yeah, so mostly when you talk about personal data, there is a very big tendency in Uganda for people to think of data in terms of MBs and mobile internet data. But really, personal data relates to any piece of information about a person on which that person can be identified. Issues like nationality, age, marital status, education level, occupation, identification numbers such as NINs and things like that are personal data. So the law first and foremost defines what personal data is. Then it goes ahead to create obligations on people it calls data collectors. Anyone can be a data collector. If you move into a company and sign into that book at the reception, you leave your name, phone number there. There you've been a data collector. If you sign up for a mobile money platform and you put in all your credentials, probably the biggest data collector at the moment, largely probably, is government, because they have everything from your birth details to your marital details to tax information to all those touch points of various e-government facilities. So then it also creates another category of people called the data processors. So I mean, to process is to take that raw data and do work around it, create things like analytics tools and things like that. Then it creates data controllers, and those are the gatekeepers or people who control personal data within the true meaning of the word. So, but the primary actor in all this is the data subject, because it's the person being protected. That's the owner of that personal data. Yeah, so it creates those categories of people. Then the Act also tries to create an administrative framework on how it will be operated. For instance, it sets up a National Data Protection Office, which will be housed at NITA, Uganda. It's the office is being set up. I mean, waiting for regulations to come into effect. Then it also creates general obligations around data types. For instance, beyond personal data, the Act goes ahead to create what's called special personal data. Mm-hmm. So issues to deal with your financial information, political opinion, and sexual orientation, as long as they are not in public domain, those are usually part of special data. The essence of that is that such data enjoys a higher protection than ordinary personal data. Mm-hmm. Then it creates security of data, and every data collector must have security safeguards to protect that data from leakages and data breaches. Issues of notification of breaches have also gained international prominence, especially maybe with banks, insurance companies, to entrench that sort of data subject rights, to make sure that they know and they are aware in case of any compromises. So generally, really, once the National Data Protection Office is set up, there will also be a register of data, a data protection register, where information data collectors will be registered and also do periodic filings about issues. For now, that's it. But the real overriding factor in this is consent.
Consent,
which is also defined in the Act. So any aspect relating to dealing, collection of personal data must be rooted by consent. So, and that consent must be informed consent, where you're informed of what your data will be used for, mm-hmm. which third parties will access it. The consent should be freely given, in the sense that there shouldn't be coercion or any of those aspects. And then the consent must also be specific and not ambiguous. So if it's a one-time consent, then it cannot be perpetual consent for you to use personal data. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm big on inclusion, and I think the key thing that I appreciated in what you were describing is people ordinarily, when they hear the word data, they think it's synonymous with the digital space. Yeah. And what I appreciate is even when you are signing into a book, as you're entering certain offices and putting your phone number and your signature, that's you giving away your data. And so every single person, whether they have a smartphone or access to the internet, needs to know about this act, because it's definitely protecting them in ways that they might not even be aware of. Maybe to move on, I would say, in your very expert opinion, 3 years later, would you say that this data protection legal framework has been effective in protecting individuals' data?
Well, I mean, the implementation of it has sort of lagged a bit, because the act was assented to in 2019. 2 years down the road, the Data Protection Office is about set off. And not yet fully operationalized, but some bit of consumer awareness, I think, is ongoing, because in all this, there are many stakeholders, and private sector is one of them. So when the law came into effect, private sector entities, mostly multinationals, banks, ride-hailing companies, hospitals, I mean, which collect ultra very sensitive personal data around people's diseases and things like that, have been trying to align by having data protection policies and making sure people sign them, consent forms and indemnities were required. So to that push, you see some significant development in that aspect. However, that's really for mostly consumers of those services. We're also seeing some positive developments in the mobile money space, where people are beginning at least to tag personal data to actual money, in the sense that if you've been compromised and you've lost your mobile money, then something probably was wrong with your personal data. It's maybe a PIN that was compromised, or maybe an identity theft scenario or something like that. So organically, I think, yeah, you feel some awareness, but also around what people are willing to disclose, because, yeah. And the big issue really around children and use of their images and social media and things like that. So that awareness, at least also with new developments, such as that WhatsApp change in terms of use, you saw, made people sort of also realize that, hey, actually it's a big thing around personal data.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Interesting. Something you've mentioned has triggered a memory, and I don't know if this qualifies to be a data breach or something. I visited one of the medical institutions here in town. I had a simple cough, I think. And this institution has several branches around the country, and I visited one in Kampala here. And yeah, I went, got the medicines, they entered my insurance details. Yeah, it came out. A few minutes later, I receive a call from a colleague upcountry who works with the same institution. And they're like, hey, Philip, what's wrong? Are you okay? What's up? I'm like, come on.
Yeah.
Guys, come on. What if this was something sensitive?
You're kidding.
For real.
This is real life.
Yes, wow. For real. So, you know, scenarios like these, and there's been several actions and directives that for me look like they're pointing to data breaches, or they were taking us to risk of the data breach. Some of these directives have even come from the government. I think another case in point is a directive allowing border border riders to collect passengers' personal data, right?
Yeah, during COVID.
Yeah, yeah, to write the details in exercise books. You know, once before you take a border, you just need to. And this has also, you mentioned something that anyone can be a data collector, which is true. But I think who is the right person to, you know, I guess my question is, does a border rider in this case qualify to have all this my information? Because now that institution is different from a bank where there's a book at the gate, because I think this is an institution which I think has policies to it. So what I'm coming to is there's been several actions. So what loopholes in this law, the existing Data Protection and Privacy Act, what loopholes have you noticed that are giving such leeways for anyone to come up and claim, or even someone, a government official, to come and say, give a directive that is giving someone who has no experience in handling data, giving them the permission to, you know, collect someone's data? So what are some of the loopholes?
You raise legitimate issues. Unfortunately, some of them are to deal with the fundamental structure of our economy. A large part of it is the informalized, in the informal sector. So if things like borders, and things, I mean, before you had ride-hailing companies, but not all borders are institutionalized within that arrangement.
Yeah.
So when issues such as COVID-19 pandemic happen, and then public transport, which also is leaking away, compromise, then those safeguards. Other challenges really relate to data sharing obligations around national security issues and investigations and things like that, which are done usually without the consent of the data subject, because you are trying to avoid a tip-off.
Yeah,
and aspects like that. But of course, every loophole could be could leave room for abuse in those circumstances. Then some, like what you pointed out, are clear cases of rogue employees.
Yeah.
Sort of a Snowden effect here that comes into force. Someone feels they can release such data. Some of it is sheer ignorance, that you do not know that children can give consent to have their pictures posted on social media, or you are at a friend's party and you do not feel the social courtesy to ask him whether you should tag him in that selfie you've taken, sometimes in uncompromising positions. But that's it.
Cool. So you see, when on the conversation, I think there's so much that can be spoken about consent, because for me, the other thing is about, so with surveillance, I think there's surveillance legislations as well in Uganda.
Yeah.
And I think one, I think it's a Chika, I don't know.
The regulation of interception.
Yes, the RICA, communication. I think, RICA. So, of course, it states that subjects are supposed to be to be informed.
Calls for a court order,
okay,
like where you, in certain circumstances, where you're to compromise on personal data.
Yeah.
And that order can even be sought without informing the data subject.
Oh, okay.
Where, it's what we call ex parte.
Because now, you don't risk a tip-off for the person. Okay.
Exactly. Makes sense. So it's a balancing act.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So when the law was passed in 2019 for Uganda, it was a landmark, because, I mean, we had set precedent in the region. I think by then Kenya didn't have any regulations there, not even Tanzania. They were still struggling. So for me, I must say it was a great achievement, even with the PR that came out from the government. And like you said, there's always something behind it. There's a pushing factor to it. But for me, I must say that was a great achievement, us having the act passed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, in the sense that I practice mostly commercial and corporate law.
Yeah.
So sometimes, like, investors are very wary about investing in countries which at least do not have certain frameworks in place.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, Uganda's positioning in East Africa, especially with the success of mobile money around Kenya, pushed such a huge interest in the country, because we already have established digital rails in terms of a payment infrastructure with mobile money. It's a very rural economy, so there are challenges around logistics. There are challenges around last mile delivery systems and platforms for basic things like getting medicines to the 80 islands that are in Lake Victoria, mm-hmm. when yeah. you can leverage that maybe with drones or with any other mobility apps and things like that. So that boomed up quite a huge demand. And of course, our positioning next to Kenya, which is an M-Pesa case study of yeah. successful digital finance and inclusion.
Mm.
Yeah. And behind all the power of that really is personal data.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there are yardsticks to these things. And of course, like you say, there's a donor-related conversation attached to all that and all these things. And I know there are yardsticks to these things. For example, there's the General Data Protection Regulation by the EU,
yeah.
which here would serve as the yardstick. I don't know, I stand to be corrected. Would you say, and for a long time people have said, Uganda is good at having good laws on paper and all these things. But would you say we match the standards? Does the act or the law on data protection match the standards?
Now, the challenge we had with the National Data and Protection Act is that it took quite a while in Parliament.
Yeah.
I think it was a bill for close to 3 or so years.
Yeah.
And this is a very fast-paced sector where almost every microsecond something is happening.
Yeah.
A VPN is being created somewhere, mm-hmm. another app is being built in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, and in all this, it's not even these tech developers can anticipate the ubiquity of the platforms that they are creating. Like the person who created the mobile phone didn't know that my 90-year-old grandmother somewhere in Western Uganda will be using it to transfer funds and right. things like that. So so what that delay caused is that the time the act came into place, a lot had changed. So GDPR is quite a recent development. But you see, Europe is much more strategic because they're a single market.
Mm-hmm.
For Uganda and other peers, what we've seen recently is a retreat by several countries to do things on their own in terms of sovereignty. That reduces your bargaining power. It also reduces your enforcement capability. GDPR, when Europe speaks, they are speaking as this one giant market.
Yeah.
And therefore, big tech can listen to them because it knows the full implications of you taking on 10, 15, 20 plus countries.
Mm.
But for Africa, if you retreat and do things in your own cocoon over things that have an impact beyond your borders,
mm.
then you do not. So that's why some people have been pushing for an East Africa digital strategy.
Yes. Mm.
And maybe also cascading the discussion at Africa Union level. So once you have such a big voice, someone knows if you switch off a platform in one country and other 3, 4, 5 countries follow suit, then the impact will be felt. Yeah. So that's where I see the fundamental on the general principles of consent and things like that, personal data definition. The Act certainly is at par with the GDPR.
Yeah.
But in terms of enforcement capacity and capability,
yeah,
quite short of it.
Okay, and what more can we celebrate? Should we even be celebrating the data that we have this, or what are some of the achievements that we've been able to see with the Data Protection and Privacy Act over the years?
Yeah, there has been quite of investor trust and confidence, some bit, of course, things like internet shutdowns undo that. We've also had quite a general development in terms of the legal system. Almost now, all the elite law firms you'll go to in Uganda have an ICT law component, part of yeah. it largely driven by the demands in the market around this area of law. It's created room for young or emerging lawyers like me.
Yeah.
Because these are new developments that, you know, but it also has low barriers of entry. I mean, if I'm a subject matter expert on this, a certain big tech CEO is comfortable seeing me on the team than an older 70-80-year-old lawyer. Mm-hmm. Unlike in other fields where if you're going to negotiate a big infrastructure project or things like that, yeah, you need. So those, there have been definitely, yeah, some dividends out of it. You see Nita being empowered, and soon you might see some revenue tricking in terms of fines and penalties for non-compliant entities.
Okay. Great.
However, I'm not advocating for
for the fines.
Well, I mean, every law has a consequence for when you breach.
Yeah.
But some of these fines are steep.
Yeah.
If you see one of them is a fine where you can be fined up to 2% of your gross income, that's taken from GDPR. If you violate the general data protection, they come for your gross income and take like 1.5-2% of it.
Very interesting. Now, we would just like to steer the conversation more towards things that I feel are relevant to, I mean, to the general masses. And now we'll talk about, you know, big tech. So WhatsApp recently announced some major updates to their application. And the way they did it, it was a take it or leave it deal on the table for the users. So it was either you give us your data or you leave and you do not use the application. How do big tech firms use our data? And is the panic around the WhatsApp update even necessary?
Well, broadly speaking, I'll say a couple of things. First, any reaction within a regulator or such as creation of a new law or an enforcement sends market signals in terms of if you're being, say, fined in France over some other practice that you're doing in Belgium or in US, it's inevitable that that trend will continue. So as a business, you're always looking at how do you de-risk from such risks that come. So the European Union in specific has always gives very periodic guidance on things such as cookies, but also on things such as disclosures. If you're going to collect data and people sign up, they are going to the extent of you saying you should disclose the third parties on whom you're going to share such data with. So that happens, and if definitely the way the ecosystem is wired is that you have big players, and these big players don't just own one app. But some of it is also commerce. I mean, we're using WhatsApp for free for now, and some point you realize you've sunk in this investment and you're looking for your monetization aspect. The shareholders and other IPO stakeholders are also asking for a dividend when the financial year ends.
Is this a price we are paying for using WhatsApp for free or something?
I mean, there is consent in these things. Yeah. That's why it's presented. It's presented as a take it or leave it deal. So if you do not consent, that's fine. But trust me, the beauty with the modern global market is that there is always a competitor also looking for where you're sleeping and falling, which explains the rise in Signal and Telegram when some people are deplatformed from WhatsApp. So those developments are happening. Some of them are legislative, others are business, pragmatic decisions.
So also in the past, What have been some emerging issues in regards to data protection and privacy?
Well, I mean, it's a very fast-growing field. Personally, I am taking keen interest in surveillance technologies, such as street CCTVs and facial recognition tools, such as artificial intelligence, people monitoring your movements from home, office, vice versa. Of course, with the also growth in data economy, sparked a discussion around the cloud economy and who enforces our privacy in the cloud. So banks are now starting to do cloud banking and some of all these aspects. Of course, I'm paying very keen attention to how social media is evolving. I think we are still in the early days of social media. So we've seen WhatsApp banking. We have seen WhatsApp for electronic KYC matched with your pattern, and a bank approval is given. We are heading into an era of electronic signatures where you don't have to go into a bank to sign a formal document, but all that can be done online. So really various ways. And for the mass market, we are also starting to see things such as the evolution of mobile money from just a service to a platform. With a mobile money wallet, you're paying utility bills at any of these points. You have intersection points with your personal data. You're paying for a farmer next door in the farmer's market. You're paying for a medical bill. You're paying for school fees. Of this, some of it is very good in the sense that once you aggregate all those transactions, it's easier to have sort of a credit score on you because we know how much you're earning and how much you're spending and to which activities. So that will improve things like access to loans and credit, financial inclusion and aspect. Some of it is risky, especially if such data gets in hands of criminal third parties. So I think as we move forward around the discussion around enforcement, discussion around digital literacy, I could easily see that being mainstreamed into our education curriculum. Yeah, if I'm being optimistic, I think right from primary school now, children need to be taught about, I mean, we now, COVID has pushed e-learning and things like this. So we will see some interesting policy shifts as well.
Great. I was just about to ask you what you think the future specifically for Uganda looks like. But I feel like you've already answered that very excellently.
Yeah.
So I guess now we'll just go over and discuss more about legislation. So
Yeah. Of course, we cannot talk about data protection and privacy without really talking about the cyber legislation. Because I feel like these play in the same field, for lack of a better word. At what point do you feel like the existing cyber legislations or laws, like the Computer Misuse Act of 2011 and others, at what point do you think they meet the standards of the Data Protection and Privacy Act?
Now, as I earlier said, this is a very fast-moving, fluid sector that keeps changing. And unfortunately, our system is quite reactive in nature. It could explain our position because we are mostly consumers of these big tech products rather than actual creators. If you're just a consumer, then you only have to wait to benchmark on what other countries have done. So if a law came into effect in 2011, I'm of the opinion that tech laws should be reviewed annually because new developments emerge and things like that. There has been a very big discussion in the US around what they call the famous Section 230, which we also have in our electronic transactions laws, which gives internet service providers immunity for what's posted on the platforms because they're mostly really treated not as the authors or the publishers, but just as platform owners. So, that discussion will continue to happen. We've seen some issues around virtual private networks in Uganda. There is no clear regulatory framework on that. I think this time round there might be a regulatory framework on virtual private networks.
Yeah. Silver, to sort of level this conversation and bring it a little bit and make it not so technical, I want us to talk about, what role does the general public, does an average Ugandan have to play, or what do they have to do on their end to ensure that maybe their data is protected? Is there like anything they can do, or what tips would you give them to ensure their data privacy and protection? Of course, I would say they don't have to scatter their data. It's not that every place you move into and they want you to register. Well, sometimes it might be for the good reasons. But for starters, I think you don't have to scatter your personal data in every place that asks for it. So what advice or tips do you give to an average Ugandan?
You see, the good thing now is that increased automation and digital onboarding, at any given time, almost any Ugandan will be on a digital platform, and that's very soon. So if we can have proper policies around data portability in the sense of easy carriage where systems are talking to each other, then you can eliminate going to NERA and they ask for the same data. You go to URA and they're asking you for the same thing. So
pick
to that,
passport, they want same data.
Exactly.
National ID, same data.
Exactly. Yeah. So I feel that some of it will inevitably happen on its own because it's actually even a cost to keep collecting all this data. But other things we can do really is usually we've tried to have companies or data collectors organize, at least have consent forms.
Yeah.
I'm very big with when I do events management for clients, it's very clear around things like wristbands.
Yeah.
If you have green, then you're comfortable with your picture being taken and shared. If you have red, you're not. If you have maybe amber, means talk to me. First, I need to understand fully. But also, it's high time we've moved towards legal and legislative translations into local languages to have these things very understood. I'm very keen on that discussion because from my position, I'm able to see the challenges even in terms of things like content moderation, where like the platform owners decide on which content to put down and which one not to keep on the platform. So once you have a certain meeting of minds, then you're able to move forward.
Ah, interesting. Thank you so much. I think the conversation of integrating data is important when it comes to government services, because you'll move to a bank, you have a national ID, but they will still ask for an LC letter from your village. And this is the same data that you have picking a permit, picking a passport. So it's frustrating. So I think there's a whole conversation that needs to be had there. So, but as we close, I want to understand, where does a Ugandan, and again, we're talking about an average Ugandan, okay? Not a privileged Ugandan. Where does a Ugandan seek redress in the event that their data, or if they feel like their data and privacy rights have been violated, and what is the procedure?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really concern me as a Ugandan is I think we are creating two or maybe three Ugandas. There is a Uganda for the privileged, there is a Uganda for... I think that discussion needs to fully evolve to back to the principles around equality.
Yes.
Because this is really like the driving spirit around such laws and policies that we make. Of course, we cannot have a full quantitative equality in terms of net worth, in terms of financial independence, but that at least should be there. So what I think in terms of redress is that every company in its data protection policy will be required to have sort of a dispute resolution clause in terms of that issue of data breach or whatever, how will it be resolved if it comes up. Of course, with the challenge we are having with very many analog but also system-based data points is the evidence that that data breach or disclosure came from a specific point you're alleging came from. Now, like your first scenario is clear. You went to a hospital and employed another one. Gave. But now, in a day, you find you have visited six offices and you've written in their book, wherever, how do you prove it came from X and Y? So those things. Then, of course, the data protection office at NITAU will also be a point in terms of filing complaints. we hope, or it's our sincere belief, that that office will at least have other regional offices in terms of reach and coverage of the entire Uganda, because not everyone can come to Kampala or afford to file a complaint online. I also see the judiciary taking very keen interest in this aspect, because I mean the courts themselves are data collectors, much as there are confidentiality and professional rules, but you also need an extra layer of security where you're handling sensitive issues like divorce cases and rights of minors and things involved within court documents, claims like adultery and things like that, which involve people who may not be related to the disputes. So issues around things like reduction in court records where you mute that person data before Elise, I see they'll become common practices.
Interesting. Yeah. One common element when it comes to implementation of these laws and acts is, I think, the penalty bit of it. And for organizations that don't have data privacy policies in place, what does the penalty look like? Is it hard enough to enforce and make sure that people pay attention to protection of individuals' data that they take in?
Yeah, I mean, by Ugandan standards, yeah, the fines are there. But now you have laws that have extraterritorial reach, which means that they apply even in countries beyond those borders. Yeah. For instance, with the GDPR, even if you're in Uganda and you collect data of a European Union citizen, then automatically the GDPR applies to you. So if you're a hotel hosting Zungu tourist or a Forex bureau helping them at a bureau de change or something like that, if you are a tour operator, and therefore you come within the law of that land. So your eyes have to be open, not just to your domestic risk, but also some of that international risk, which can carry foreign-denominated penalties and fines, which can be very, very steep. But I really think the emphasis largely should be put on the compliance side, because on their own, fines can do so much.
Yeah.
But also, this money sometimes rarely goes to actual people who have been harmed. So if you go and pay a fine, it's a corporate offense. A quick lawyer will immediately settle a case, especially if multiple breaches are concerned. But it does not resolve the real underlying issue in terms of proper data protection safeguards, in terms of other unforeseen risks. If maybe your data, you may not know it's in the dark web or something like that. So I think really, to me, the first line of defense is always to err on the side of compliance.
Well, lastly, Silva, from me, Charity, if you'll allow me, how do we get this conversation to the grassroots, really? I know for some of the grassroots, it might not be relatable, but how do we get the conversation to the people and let them understand?
Yeah, I mean, initiatives like these, my podcasts for a certain class, maybe later radios, get the message abroad. We've talked around issues such as material translation, be them laws, be them training kits.
Yeah.
We've talked about school and curriculum change, having a bit of this embedded within social studies, within ICT, within all these courses in a holistic and integral manner, things like that. But also speaking up when compromises happen, when breaches happen, and sometimes asking the tough questions, you know. Yeah.
Well, it turns out the conversation is now being had on social media after the recent ride-hailing scenario around data. And I think it should change. We shouldn't be having these conversations only when these such scenarios happen. I think you make a good point. They need to go back to the people, and we use the easiest platforms available.
Yeah, I mean, social media, you can't write it off, because we've seen social media impacting even conversations offline. Yeah. But also social media is a trendsetter on what's discussed on radio and other things.
Right.
So that's why its potency ease in terms of the effect. But I do agree with you that even churches, mosques, customary leaders, I mean, there is a very big debate around this and content moderation. I mean, if you have communities that have a certain bit of their culture as not fully dressing up, and you take pictures that offend nudity provisions of terms of use, and such pictures are deplatformed when actually consent was given for such images. So I think those kind of multifaceted approach is really, really what will get be the game changer.
Thank you. I feel like this has been a crash course on data protection and privacy, correct, and what to expect, not just within the Ugandan realm, but, you know, largely at a regional level. Like, what are we doing? What are we preparing for? So thank you, Silva. If people would like to reach out to you, maybe for private consultancy or engagements outside of this podcast, you know, you mentioned making this information accessible at a more inclusive level, you know, radio stations and stuff like that. How can they get in touch with you?
Well, yeah, I have a personal website, silvakayondo.com, and it has all the contact details from phone number to email address and a catalog of my service offering there. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. That's all from all of us today. Thank you so much for joining us again, Silva. To all our listeners, please stay tuned and look out for our next episode as we present to you voices and perspectives of human rights defenders in Uganda. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. And if you have any feedback or if you need to learn more about the Digital Human Rights Lab, visit www.digitalhumanrightslab.org. You can also follow us on our social media channels on Twitter, on Facebook as DHR Lab or Digital Human Rights Lab, and on Instagram as the DIG Human Rights Lab. Thank you. Till next time, that's all from all of us, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.